Well, Philip Yancey, as I mentioned his book several times in this series, What's So Amazing About Grace, he writes a true story in the book about a young girl who grew up in a cherry orchard just above Traverse City, Michigan. She had parents loved her like crazy, but they tended to overreact to the music she listened to, her nose ring, the length of her skirts, on and went. And so one evening they had a blow up and she ran up to her bedroom, and her father went up there shortly after the argument, knocked on her door, and she yelled, "I hate you, go away." And so that night she decided that she would facilitate the plan she's had in her mind for a while, and she runs away to Detroit. On her second day, she meets a man who offers her a ride in his beautiful car, buys her lunch, arranges for a place for her to stay, and she gives her some pills that make her feel better than she's ever felt before. She's living a good life now, living in a penthouse, ordering from room service whenever she wants to. The man whom she met, whom she now calls boss, teaches her some things that men like and are willing to pay dearly for. Occasionally during this lifestyle, she'll think of her parents, but their life seems so boring now. After about a year, the first sign of illness appears, and it amazes her how fast her boss turns mean. Before you know it, she's living on the streets and hustling just enough money to support her drug habit. When winter sets in, she finds herself sleeping in the metal grates in front of a large department store, her cough worsening. She thinks in her mind she no longer feels like a woman of the world, but instead like a lost little girl in a cold and frightening city. And she longs dearly for home. And crying, she begins to ask, "Why did I ever leave? My dog back home eats better than I do now." 3 straight phone calls home, 3 straight connections with the answering machine. The first 2 she hangs up. On the 3rd try, she leaves this message: "Dad, Mom, it's me. I was wondering about coming home. I'm catching a bus your way, and I'll get there about midnight tomorrow. If you're not there, well, I guess I'll stay on the bus until it hits Canada." The 7-hour bus ride home, she wonders if her parents are out of town and didn't get the message. Maybe she should have waited a day or two. Maybe she should have talked to them. Perhaps her dad's still too angry to speak with her. So the bus pulls into the station, and the driver announces over the speaker, "15 minutes, folks, 15 minutes. That's all we have here." 15 minutes to decide her life. Nervously, she gets off the bus, not knowing what to expect. She walks in the terminal as no way prepared for the scene that's before her. There in the terminal stands a group of 40 people, brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles, cousins, grandparents, all wearing goofy hats, party hats, blowing noisemakers. Her dad steps out of the crowd. Tears in her eyes, she says, "Dad, I'm so sorry," and he stops her. "Hush, sweetheart. You don't have time for that right now. You'll be late for the party. A banquet's waiting you." A party? A banquet? For somebody that caused so much pain? For somebody that's done so much wrong? Is that fair? Is it right? Does it make any sense? It does make sense, but only to a lovesick father, a brokenhearted father, a brokenhearted mother. Is it fair? No, it's not fair. It's grace. It's grace. And so often, somebody that has sinned or fallen away from God, or maybe even people that don't know God, think of God as an angry God, a distant, thundering figure who prefers fear and respect to love. But Jesus sets the record straight. He tells a story of a father publicly humiliating himself by rushing out to embrace a son who squandered half of the family fortune. We know it as the story of the prodigal son. Let's look at it this morning. Luke 15, verse 11 and following. Jesus continued, "There was a man who had 2 sons. The younger one said to his father, 'Father, give me my share of the estate.' So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in the whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country, who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, "How many of my father's hired men have food to spare? And here I am starving to death. I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired men.' So he got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him, ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. The son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fatted calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For the son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' So they began to celebrate. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near their house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. 'Your brother has come,' he replied, 'and your father has killed a fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound.' The older brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, 'Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders, yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours has squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home, you kill the fatted calf for him.' 'My son,' the father said, 'you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost, and he is found.'" It's interesting, if you notice that the son returns home, there's no solemn lecture, "I hope you learned your lesson." Rather, Jesus tells the story of the father's exhilaration. "The son of mine was dead and is alive. He's lost, and now he's found." And Jesus proclaims they began to celebrate. There's so much that can be learned from the story of the prodigal son, not the least of which is grace. And I think the story gives us a glimpse into what motivates God to administer grace. The story of the prodigal son appears in a string of three stories by Jesus: the lost sheep, the lost coin, the lost son. All items that are important, all items of value. Each story makes the same point in a sense: the sense of loss, the thrill of rediscovery, and the experience of jubilation when it's found. And Jesus remarks while he's telling these stories, "In the same way, I tell you, there is rejoicing in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents." And Jesus let us know that for the Father, it's not about keeping score. It's about grace. It's about the restoration of relationships. For God, grace is about restoration of relationship, both at the time when you accept Christ and you become saved and cleansed and a child of God. That's grace. "For by grace you have been saved, not of works, lest any man should boast." And so it's about relationships at the time when you're saved, and it's also about a relationship when you have sin in your life as a child of God, as a follower of Christ. This time of restoration. Grace is about restoration of relationship when you've had a falling out with God. And grace is about restoration of relationship where there's been a falling out between you and your mate or your children or your sister or brother or really any relationship you have in your life. Grace is about a restoring of relationship. And grace, according to the Bible, is shockingly personal. Henry Nouwen points this out. He said, "God rejoices not because the problems of the world have been solved, not because all human pain and suffering have come to an end, not because thousands of people have been converted and now praising him for his goodness. No, God rejoices because one of his children who was lost has been found." And we've looked in times, weeks past, at the unfairness of grace. We love grace. We said we cannot earn it, did not deserve it, are not worthy of it. And yet, God extends grace. Last week, we looked at the world we live in, which we said is full of ungrace, no grace. We are surrounded by a world and a society that knows very little about grace. In our work environment, we receive pay for our labors. In a financial environment, we pay for something, we lose it. We said, you may have a grace period on a loan, but it's not indefinite. In our social environment, we are expected to look good, be good, and make good, and we don't. Very little grace. In the world we live in and function in, grace is not natural for us. It's not our first inclination. And grace is not natural for the religious leader, the ultra-religious leader either. When Jesus spoke the parables of grace, the Pharisees stood on the edge of the crowd muttering and grinding their teeth. Couldn't believe some of the things he's speaking. In the stories of the lost sheep and the lost coin, the friend finds and finds them. The neighbors are called to rejoice when those lost items are found. And it's interesting to me when the stories shift from stuff, when the story shifts from possessions to a person. In the story of the prodigal son, Jesus brings in the voice of the older brother. And the older brother shows outrage at his father for rewarding irresponsible behavior. What kind of family values would his father communicate by throwing a party for such a renegade? How is this possible? What are you thinking? It's a well-known preacher by Fred Craddock. He passed away last March. He's been called one of the most influential preachers in the last half century. He was a genius at storytelling. He once had a sermon where he tinkered with the details of the prodigal son's parable to make a point. In a sermon, he had the father slip the ring and robe on the elder brother, kill the fatted calf in honor of his years of faithfulness and obedience. And a woman in the back of the sanctuary yelled out, "That's the way it should have been written." Because we relate to that. The problem is we don't understand grace. We think we should have earned it. In the story, of course, the elder brother represents the self-righteous, the Pharisees and the teachers of the day that were standing by. If the story would have been written about the elder son getting that, then it would have been about a reward, not grace. The truth is, God says a lot about rewards. But he talks about a reward for you in your life after you've accepted Christ. And the way you've lived your life, he talks a lot about rewards as living for Christ once you know him. A natural way of thinking is that we need to clean up our act before we go before a holy God. The only problem is it's only God who can clean us up. It's grace. It's the Father who runs and cleans up the Son. It's the Father who restores him, puts on clean clothes, and makes him honorable once again. It's the Father that does that, not the Son. The Son came with nothing because he had nothing, and he saw it. And Jesus teaches us so much about forgiveness, grace. One of his last acts before death, Jesus forgives a thief on a cross that's dangling next to him, knowing full well that the thief was probably converting out of plain fear. Jesus said, "That's okay. It's grace." Yancey writes in his book, "It was another shocking reminder that grace does not depend on what we have done for God, but rather what God has done for us." Listen to that again. "It was another shocking reminder that grace does not depend on what we have done for God, but rather what God has done for us." When we begin to understand this, we begin to get a grasp of this. We begin to understand what's happening. We begin to live our lives with an awareness that we are surrounded by God's grace. Every day, every week, God abundantly pours his grace into our lives. And God pours grace into your life simply because he loves you. Long time ago, somebody asked me, "Was grace the same as God's love?" It may seem that way, but God's agape love stands on its own, and it's important to understand the distinction. We've often looked at the biblical definition of love and the contrasting differences between the three main Greek words for love. There's at least five, but there's three main ones, and we've looked at this in depth in years past over the times. We've often said that we have one word for love. The Greeks, they separated. They had different. Every time they had the eros, phileo, and agape. Eros is erotic, if you would, but it's sensual. It doesn't necessarily mean erotica like you would. It can mean that, but anything your senses. You know, you like things, you like to taste. Phileo is Philadelphia love, you know, brother city of brotherly love. And agape is a God kind of love. And we say we love everything. We've often used the expression, we love pizza, we love chocolate, we love our dog, and we love our wife or husband. You know, I would hope there'd be some kind of distinction, right? And so it gets lost in all of that. But God's love, God's agape love, is unconditional. God's agape love reaches out and reaches towards. And agape love belongs to Christianity. It's been said that the Greeks had agape in a sense in their dictionary, if you would, but nobody ever really knew how to use it until Jesus started using it. Because it could only apply to the Father. This unconditional, reaching towards incredible, beautiful, agape love that God has. In every other faith, man reaches out in some way to please God. Only in Christianity is God reach for man. Every other faith, we're trying to do something. Man is trying to do something to satisfy his gods in some way to be approved and met. And God said, you can't do it. I'll reach out and I'll make the way. So agape love, God's love, stands separate from his grace. Yet it's God's agape love that insists that he functions in divine grace. We know this scripture well. John 3:16, for God so loved the world, God so agaped the world that he gave his only begotten Son, whoever believes in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. The Bible teaches us that God is love. It's who he is. It's he is love. It's everything about him. It's his very nature. And we also saw last week that God is full of grace and truth. And you begin to see a little bit of distinction. John 1:14, and the word became flesh and dwelt among us. We beheld his glory. The glory is the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. Grace is a function of God's incomparable love he has for you. So God is love, and he's full of grace and full of truth. And we looked at that at length last week, and it's such a time of rejoicing to know that you come before a God that loves you, that is full of love, and he's full of grace and full of truth. It's his love and grace that he pours into your life abundantly and continually. Grace is a function of God's incomparable love that he has for you. Vine's Expository Dictionary, New Testament Word, speaks of agape love saying this, love that can only be known only from the action it prompts. Love that can be known only from the action it prompts. God's agape love prompts his action of grace towards you daily. It's this credible, incredible, unconditional love that he can't help it. Out of his agape love towards you, he functions and extends grace, this wonderful, amazing grace. We struggle. We stumble. We have pain. And yet God tells us what? His grace is sufficient. It's God's grace that pulls you through when you're going through a difficult time. You reach a point where you don't think you can make it. You begin to wonder if God's around anymore, if he even knows about your pain, or worse yet, if he even cares about the pain you're in. He knows, he cares, and he proclaims his grace is sufficient. Some of you may have heard of an evangelist named David Ring. He was born in 1953 with cerebral palsy. Actually, he was born dead. He laid him on a bed at a table in the corner of the room for 18 minutes when he was born, before he took his first breath. His father was a preacher who died when he was a little boy. His mother, who was his whole world, she was the only one that understood him. He was rejected. He had cerebral palsy. He had learning issues. His mother was the only one that offered love, only one that understood him. And she died when he was 11 years old. He cried out to God to save her, and he died. His life story is incredibly moving. I mean, you can feel the pain. If you've ever watched the DVD or a video or heard him preach, you can feel the pain he endured. He'll lift your spirits towards God with hope like you never heard. And his message, he preaches all the time, many, many evenings, all over the country, and his message is centered on his life scripture verse, God's grace is sufficient. We'll watch just a couple minutes of David's story.
Every one of you has a story. You don't have my story. I don't have your story. But we all have a story, don't we? If you don't tell your story will not get told. Let me ask you, are you telling your story? When I stand and speak night after night, all over this country, when I open my mouth, people think I have a handicap. I don't have a handicap. I have a platform to tell my story. Some people think, some people think I have a disability. I don't. I have a platform to tell my story. Some people think I have a problem. I don't. I have an opportunity to tell my story. Some people think I have a burden. I don't have a burden. I have a blessing to tell my story. Come on. Glory to the Lamb of God. And I thank God for allowing me to be born with cerebral palsy. And I want to say something that you may not understand. But if God gave me a choice today to leave this building with a healthy body or to leave with a cerebral palsy body, I'd take cerebral palsy any day over a healthy body. Because when I'm weak, then I am strong.
His expression when he gets up to preach, he said, I have cerebral palsy, what's your excuse? David proclaims 2 Corinthians 9:10 as his life's verse. But he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses so that Christ's power may rest on me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses and insults and hardships and persecutions and difficulties. For when I am weak, then I am strong. When I'm weak, when I recognize my weaknesses, when I struggle and I stumble, it's God's grace that strengthens me and enables me and sustains me. When we don't recognize our weaknesses, we think we can handle it. We don't need help. We don't need God. It's kind of like I've used this probably illustration in the past, but if I went to move this pulpit over and somebody came up and said, oh, let me help, and I said, no, I got it. I get it. That's all right. See, when we go to God like that, we're saying we don't need help. But when we come to God saying, I'm done. I need you, then we're strengthened in him. That's understanding his grace that's sufficient. And how sad that when we don't fully understand it, fully comprehend God's grace, we don't function in it. We don't rely on it. In our lives, and then we've said that all the lives, all the world around us, people are hungry for grace. But instead of seeking God's grace, they search for all sorts of substitutes. In the 1980s, a man created an apology sound-off telephone line. It was a telephone service that gave callers the opportunity to call in and leave an apology on a message machine, you know, answering machine, anonymously, confess their wrongs and apologize for them. Instead of turning to God, they turn to an answering machine. They received over 200 calls a day, from the simplest silly mistake to adultery was very common, criminal acts, rape, child abuse, sexual abuse, even murder was confessed and apologized for. Not to the person who was wrong, and certainly not to God, to an inanimate answering machine. Things have changed now in our computer world. There are several online sites where you can go and you're going to post an apology anonymously. There is, of course, an app that you can put on your phone that lets you apologize anonymously. Some time ago, somebody opened a bar in China that became quickly the most popular bar. It's called the Cry Bar. Customers could come and pay an hourly fee, about $6 or $8 an hour, plus the cost of the drinks, to come in and cry. Bartenders played sad music. Dolls are available for customers to throw around or beat while they vent about their broken relationships. It became a hugely popular bar. The owner said he used to run a marriage agency, only to discover that many of his clients had an immense desire to cry, but in their culture could not find an opportunity. So the idea for the bar was born. A place to get rid of this guilt, this anger, this whatever. Problem is, there's no grace found in an answering machine or on a phone app. You won't find grace at a cry bar or any bar, for that matter. Certainly not true divine grace. The hunger for grace we all share drives so many of us to search for it, only to find poor substitutes. Addictions of food, alcohol, drugs, sex are weak and destructive attempts to satisfy this need for grace. Many of the frustrations we experience, anger, hurt, greed, lust, envy, and jealousy, are outward signs of an inward hunger. It's been said that it's like homeless people searching through trash bins for something, anyway, anything to take away the hunger and the hurt. We search through the trash bins of life, if you will, to try to appease this hunger for grace. We find substitutes for the real thing, God's banquet table of grace. And it's a sign that we don't understand God's grace. And perhaps it's how we hear the scripture that causes pause. My grace is sufficient for you. Sufficient? When is God sufficient in anything? When it comes to God, I want more than sufficient. I expect more than sufficient. Have you ever known God to be sufficient, just adequate? We're talking about God of the burning bush and the Red Sea, the part of the Red Sea. See, God's far bigger than anything. He's certainly far bigger than sufficient. I mean, sufficient, instead of the burning bush, he could have just went, psst, Moses, hey, over here. That would have been sufficient. God causes Israelites to go past the sea on dry ground and destroys Pharaoh's violent army when they're drowned when they try to follow. The horse and the rider are thrown into the sea. God is more than enough, more than sufficient. He's so far beyond adequate. God never does things halfway. And the problem is how we hear the word sufficient. There is something lost in the translation from the original meaning. When God said he is sufficient, his grace is sufficient, he means his grace is far more than enough. It's so much more than you'll ever need. There's no need to look anywhere else. There's no substitute for God's grace. And in the original language, in the original wording, it's called a perfect tense, and it means it's made complete or completely done. We see sufficient as that's sufficient. Which of you ladies, if you spent all day cooking a wonderful Thanksgiving meal, an example, full of six or seven pies and all the trimmings, and we said, it was sufficient. You know, it wouldn't go over very good, would it? It's because how we see sufficient. But the language means it's done, it's perfect, it's complete. And it also means, because it's a perfect tense, it's continually available, nonstop, through every circumstance and every situation. Man, I wish I had a better word than sufficient. Because it's just lost the meaning of the power of this daily grace. It goes back to understanding the Father's heart, God's heart. Jesus was always talking about his Father's heart. God's heart of grace is revealed in the very first book of the Bible. When we think of the fall, we think of the garden. Who do we think of? Adam and Eve. They had a great relationship with God. And then Adam fell. He blew it. Adam and Eve blew it, and God was upset with them. We think of them, and we can relate. In our hearts, we realize how many times we just blew it again. So it's natural to think like that. Adam and Eve, God was upset with them. He's upset with us. We blew it. In the garden, in the fall, and in our faults and failures, there is a break in the relationship. That's what sin does. It destroys. Yet there's a story of the prodigal son. There's a side that we so often miss. When Adam and Eve fell, they could no longer be with God. There are no more long walks with God in the cool of the day. They're not allowed in the garden. They're not allowed in God's holy presence. And I think we can relate with Adam and Eve. We relate with the tremendous loss. What seems to be our nature. Our nature is we look at how things affect us. What we have lost. They were in the garden. They had it all together. Man, wouldn't it be nice to have some time in the garden? They lost all that. Have you ever thought about what God lost? Have you considered that when God walked with them, that perhaps it was a highlight of his day? That he looked forward to it? When the prodigal son comes home, it's the father who's delighted. It's the father who rejoices. It's the father who runs to greet his son. And it's the father's response that sets the tone for everything else and everyone else. It's your heavenly father's response that when you're saved, that causes the angels in heaven to rejoice with him. It's God's heart. It's a response of love and grace. And how do you suppose the father and the prodigal son responded to the son the day after the party? The week after? Years after? I think every time he saw him, he thought, I'm so glad he's back. I missed him so much. So here's our question for today. Are there any relationships in your life that need to be restored? What's holding you back? Now, in a broken relationship, you're only responsible for how you act. When you reach out to restore a relationship and they don't want to deal with it, they're hard to deal with, you're not responsible for their behavior. You're only responsible for your side of it. We thought about the father, how he responded to the prodigal son for years and years after. I wonder how the elder brother responded. For years after. Most likely he didn't change much. Most likely he nursed a grudge for the rest of his life. Most likely he missed out on a wonderful relationship he could have had with his brother over a misunderstanding. Most likely his attitude damaged the relationship with his father as well. Here's your next question of the day. Who do you tend to be more like? The father or the brother? Not easy questions to answer, but we need to. You'll see more of God's grace in your life when you fully understand God's grace and how he functions in it and how his agape love drives him to function in grace. When you fully understand God's grace and how he functions in it, you will extend more of God's grace towards others when they need it. Because grace, amazing grace, is all about restoration of relationships. Grace, relationships. Living your life, loving God's grace, and extending God's grace. I invite the worship team to come forward. As they're coming forward, I can relate to the story of the prodigal son. I can relate to this father. I remember once my older son, when he was younger, 17 maybe at the most, did a very stupid thing, got caught and he ran away, took his car and left. For days we had no idea where he went. He was just gone. Days before cell phones, couldn't talk to him. I was a wreck. Couldn't work, couldn't think, could pray, barely pray. How do I reach him? He could be anywhere. I tried getting a hold of him. I went to his call, all of his friends, and said, listen, if he calls you, have him call his dad. Went to the school every day when the kids got out. Have you heard from him? Have you seen him? Prayed constantly. So finally, friends got a hold of him, and he called. He had no money. Got in his car. I think he got as far as Nashville before he ran out of money and was sleeping underneath a tree one night. He's a big guy, strong guy. Six guys jumped him. Somehow, by the grace of God, he fought them off. I mean, what could have been the outcome? So he called. I got a ticket. Flew down to where he was, met with him, drove him home. I've had years of a wonderful relationship with him. I mean, he's older now, he's married, you know, he's 40s or whatever, you know. But I understand what it is to have grace in a relationship. And I have a hint of understanding how much the Father loves you. And how he so desires to give you grace when you need it. When you feel like you've ran away, or you feel like you've given up, or you've hurt God, or you have no idea how to get to God. He said, it's me, I'll do it, I'll bring us together. Let's stand and worship our God this morning.